superior logic, not the think tank equivalent of negative ads, which is what places like Heritage often traffic in, along with a heavy dose of anti-liberal jingoism. Basically, everybody in AEI's world is politically conservative, but they believe that this vision of lifting people up is the best way to get it done, says Arthur Brooks. And they want to be able to do that while feeling good about it and not hating people on the political left who think they have a better way of helping people. That's been the magic. While Heritage claims to have 700,000 donors, AEI's sizable budget comes from under 1,500 contributors, who give an average of $35,000 a year. Around 65% of its revenues come from individual donors, and Brooks works hard to cultivate these supporters. In 2015, he made 90 out-of-town trips and gave 179 speeches. Brooks believes that getting people excited about AEI's vision and scholarship is the best way to reel in contributions, as opposed to an outright ask or a red meat ideological appeal. We don't sell de facto membership in the conservative movement, Brooks told me. We don't do anything like that. We appeal to people who are just super interested in ideas and who believe that ideas have huge consequences. This is a niche offering in the Washington policy bazaar, and Brooks has played to it, stressing AEI's intellectualism at every turn in an unspoken contrast to other think tanks on the right. Virtually my whole board has spent some time in graduate school doing something like classics, philosophy, something in the social sciences, Brooks says. They all have these weird backgrounds. They're basically intellectuals who wound up running hedge funds, private equity firms, who became CEOs. But they never lost their love for ideas and their belief that ideas are what propel the world forward. A perfect example is Bruce Kovner, a Manhattan-based billionaire and retired hedge fund manager who epitomizes conservative cosmopolitanism and has been on AEI's board for decades, including 6 years as its chair. Kovner was born into a Jewish family with immigrant roots. His grandparents had fled the pogroms in Russia and Poland in the late 19th century, eventually ending up in Brooklyn. Kovner grew up in the suburbs of Los Angeles, where his father moved when he was young. He was a young Democrat, and his hero was President John F. Kennedy. The popular idea at the time was that the Democrats and FDR were committed to fairness, and the Republicans were committed to greed, Kovner would recall. I grew up in that kind of household. He attended Harvard on a scholarship, studied at the Kennedy School of Government as a grad student, and worked as a writer and cab driver. He dabbled in investing on the side, from his one-bedroom apartment on 57th Street in Manhattan, speculating on commodity prices, interest rates, and currencies, before becoming a trader at the Commodities Corporation, which had been started by economists from MIT and Princeton. Kovner was very successful there and went on to found his own firm, Caxton Associates, in the early 1980s. That firm helped pioneer new kinds of advanced techniques to understand and profit from financial markets, including mastering derivatives. Starting with an initial investment of $10 million, nearly half of which was Kovner's own money, Caxton earned around $3 billion in profits in its first decade, with a gross trading return of 55.6% per year. By the time he retired in 2011, Kovner was worth $5 billion. Kovner didn't turn to the right as a result of getting rich. He moved to the right long before that, at Harvard in the 1960s, under the influence of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then a professor at the university, whom Kovner would call one of the most important influences of my life. Kovner says of Moynihan, he explained how the war on poverty of the mid-60s was not extinguishing poverty, but creating bureaucratic dysfunction and a class dependent on welfare. Kovner recalls that as a big revelation. I came from a background where the mere intention to eradicate poverty was a badge of honor, sufficient to do the job. I learned that good intentions are not enough. I learned economics. Kovner joined the AEI board in 1989 at the invitation of its president at the time, Chris DeMuth, whom he knew from Harvard. Before DeMuth got in touch with him, Kovner hadn't spent much time thinking about think tanks or AEI. But the more closely he looked at AEI, the more he liked it. I realized that AEI stood for two of the core principles in my life. First, defending the vision of America as a place committed to free enterprise and personal liberty. Second, the necessity of a serious and assertive military and foreign policy that would defend America in a dangerous world. Kovner is typical among conservatives in that he views free enterprise as the most powerful tool to fight poverty and ensure meritocratic outcomes. We know that the free market economy has lifted hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people from poverty, he said. I want to support institutions that promote those policies. As it happens, though, hedge fund managers like Kovner have benefited in big and direct ways from the definition of free enterprise that outfits like AEI put forth. For example, scholars at AEI have vigorously defended taxing capital gains at a much lower rate than earned income, a bifurcation that yields huge benefits to the wealthiest Americans, who are much more likely to derive their income from investments. AEI scholars have even defended the much-derided loophole on carried interest, which allows hedge funds and private equity groups to define fees generated by investing other people's money as capital gains, as opposed to regular income derived from performing a service. Scholars at AEI have also opposed stronger regulation of Wall Street, despite the rise of a shadow banking system starting in the 1990s, one that includes asset management firms like hedge funds with a strong appetite for risk, yet subject to little oversight. Many accounts of the 2008 financial crisis implicated this system in helping bring down the economy. But AEI scholars have contested this view, and one wrote, "The calls from regulators and others for additional regulation of so-called shadow banks are a rush to judgment. To impose additional regulation on the shadow banking or securities system would add costs that will impair economic growth." AEI scholars have tended to blame government, not Wall Streeters, who largely pay their salaries, for the financial crisis. Like many top hedge fund managers who have become billionaires in recent decades, Bruce Kovner made his fortune in an era when financial regulations were being dismantled in Washington and taxes on capital gains reduced to record low levels, with policy groups like AEI helping to accomplish these goals. Kovner got rich primarily because he brought smart new approaches to investing, but the ascendancy of laissez-faire ideas, starting in the 1980s, helped him get richer than he might have otherwise. Arthur Brooks dismisses the idea that financial self-interest might be a motivator for AEI's donors. It would be a really, truly terrible cost-benefit calculation for a donor to give $1 million to a think tank, hoping that somewhere down the line that think tank would actually result in changed policy and lower that person's taxes, he says. The connection between ideas and legislative action is too roundabout, and there are more direct ways to lobby for one's financial self-interest other than giving to think tanks. It's a terrible investment, and those guys didn't get rich with bad investments. Further, Brooks doesn't think that winning favorable treatment by public officials is even much on the minds of AEI's donors, many of whom have so much money that a little more isn't going to make a difference. They happily live in high-tax places like New York City and California, as opposed to maneuvering for every last financial edge. A lot of our donors think their taxes are too high, but as a matter of principle, they're not that worried about their own taxes, Brooks says. They're offended by a sprawling, mediocre, huge, all-encompassing blob of a government that they think is suffocating initiative and excellence. That's what they really bridle against. In point of fact, my donors care less about the money than it might appear. Brooks might have added that most people come to their ideological beliefs early in life, well before they start rising in their careers, a point also true of philanthropists, Bruce Kovner being one example. Wealth offers a way to promote long-held views. it's less likely to account for these views. To Brooks, the ideal AEI donor is not someone looking for near-term policy wins in Washington, and he doesn't promise that kind of return. Rather, he's looking for donors who understand that ideas can have a slow-burn impact, get into the culture, get into the media, get into the conversation, sometimes get into politicians' brains. Regardless of what AEI's backers may be thinking, there's no denying that wealthy donors are far more likely to align themselves with think tanks that side with corporations and Wall Street in policy fights. Meanwhile, groups that stand up for lower-income Americans, like the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, have a much harder time attracting affluent backers and tend to be smaller in size. Most of their money comes from liberal foundations where the original donor is long dead and quite possibly rolling in his grave, while raising big money from individuals can be an uphill climb. The more structural a think tank's critique of capitalism, the harder time it has cultivating major donors. Unsurprisingly, wealthy Americans who have benefited from the economic status quo are less interested in challenging it. That imbalance mirrors a broader tilt in Washington and in state capitals. The wealthy have more powerful representatives in these places than do citizens lower on the economic ladder. This tilt has grown ever more pronounced since the 1980s, as political scientists such as Kay Schlossman and Jacob Hacker have shown, amid the decline of unions and an explosion of business trade groups and lobbyists, underscoring E.E. Schottschneider's famous remark that the heavenly chorus of American pluralism sings with a strong upper-class accent. The expansion of conservative think tanks like AEI is a key part of this story. The class tilt is likely to keep growing, too. Thanks to recent boom times and historically low tax rates, the wealthy now have more spare cash than ever before to put behind their economic views, which tend to be more conservative than those held by ordinary Americans. Investing in think tanks may indeed be a roundabout way to achieve policy change, as Arthur Brooks notes, but putting money elsewhere, say behind presidential candidates, carries its own pitfalls. Just ask all the mega donors on the right who gave at a record level to elect Mitt Romney in 2012, only to watch Barack Obama prevail. 4 years later, no big donors on the Republican side were able to stop Donald Trump from winning the GOP nomination. In contrast to the crapshoot of electoral politics, investing in think tanks offers a reliable and proven way to slowly change policy and culture over time, and without the high-profile controversies that can come with partisan giving, which is often a concern to wealthy donors who also run businesses. This helps explain why, in early 2016, reports leaked out that Charles and David Koch were shifting their attention away from federal electoral campaigns and back toward philanthropy. The brothers, wrote National Review, had always believed that building the intellectual foundation for libertarian ideas in think tanks and universities and supporting important public policy initiatives at the state and local levels paid greater long-term dividends than spending on elections. Now, tired of being publicly vilified in ways that hurt their sprawling company, Koch Industries, they were inclined to shift back to that focus. Whatever the Kochs choose to do, a torrent of new money is already flowing into think tanks on the right, and not just AEI. The Heritage Foundation's revenues have, in recent years, cracked the $100 million mark for the first time. In 2013, Heritage landed the largest gift in its history for $26 million. A year later, AEI pulled in its largest ever gift when one of its board members, Daniel Daniello, gave $20 million for a new building. It was Brooks's finest moment yet as a fundraiser. Daniello is the billionaire co-founder of the Carlyle Group, the famed Washington-based private equity firm. He grew up in a struggling Italian Catholic family in a Pennsylvania coal mining town. His single mother never earned more than $6,000 a year, before attending Syracuse University on a scholarship and getting an MBA from Harvard Business School. After that, Daniello worked his way upward in corporate America, first at TWA and then at PepsiCo and Marriott. He founded the Carlyle Group in 1987 with a colleague from Marriott and three other partners, backed by $5 million from investors. These days, Carlyle has nearly $178 billion in assets under management, and the three founders still with the firm, including Daniello, have a combined net worth of nearly $10 billion. Daniello is no former social science grad student like Kovner, but is instead the kind of values-driven donor that Arthur Brooks describes. And he explained his record gift to AEI in terms of his worldview and life experience. "Promoting and protecting free enterprise and opportunity is personal for me," Daniello said. "It's what enabled my firm to grow and thrive, and I want all people to have the same shot at achieving the American dream." Brooks got to know Daniello when Brooks was still a professor at Syracuse, and Daniello sat on its board of trustees. Both men love Syracuse because it sees itself as a top-tier school for the everyman, as opposed to the prep school crowd. They became friends and, later, found themselves working closely together at AEI, with Daniello becoming vice chair of the AEI board. The billionaire came to take a keen interest in AEI's quest for a new headquarters and finally stepped up to help in a decisive way. While Daniello's motives for bankrolling AEI's expansion seem pure enough, his backstory is not entirely about the unalloyed triumph of free enterprise. A long line of critics of the Carlyle Group have argued that the firm, which has employed many former top U.S. government officials, epitomizes access capitalism. Former Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, who joined the firm as chairman in 1992, helped orchestrate some of its biggest early paydays, investing in Pentagon contractors. Other former officials who helped Carlyle prosper at the lucrative nexus of government and industry have included James Baker, Richard Darman, and former President George H.W. Bush. In fairness to Daniello, this kind of thing has gone on since the days of the Roman Republic, and today's access game is played by people of all ideological stripes. In a not-so-virtuous cycle, political ties can be used to win preferential treatment by government, in the form, say, of low tax rates or favorable regulations or lucrative contracts, that leads to greater riches and the ability of business winners to spend yet more money currying the favor of the political class. If you want to understand why the rich get richer, as the saying goes, Washington, D.C. is one place to look. Two political scientists who did just that, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, concluded in their book, Winner Take All Politics, that the clout of wealthy interests in the nation's capital has been a bigger driver of inequality than the usual suspects of globalization and technological change. In turn, a massive concentration of wealth at the top of the income ladder has armed the upper class with even more resources with which to wield political power. Philanthropy is playing a growing role in this feedback loop as more givers with deeper pockets bankroll think tanks that have the ear of top officials. Most ordinary people have limited options for being heard in a noisy public square. They can start petitions or send tweets or write letters or engage in other activities aimed at influencing policy. Citizen activists do occasionally have impact. Think of the leaders of the Tea Party or Black Lives Matter, but they are wielding slingshots compared to the wealthy. If you're rich, you can pay the salaries of policy experts to advance your beliefs within the corridors of power. You can underwrite books and magazines to sway broader audiences. You can support lawyers who use litigation to achieve change. You can finance pop-up PR blitzes, like the campaign to fix the debt. Some 200 people are now working in the new Daniel Daniello building that houses the American Enterprise Institute, a short cab ride away from a White House where some AEI scholars used to work, and may one day work again when Republicans are back in charge there. Fittingly, the Beaux Arts-style building once housed luxury apartments, including one for Andrew Mellon, the industrialist and banker who parlayed his wealth into a post as U.S. Treasury Secretary during the 1920s, where he pushed through sweeping tax cuts for the rich. D'Aniello hasn't signed the giving pledge and doesn't plan to. "It's too public and showy," he said. "It just didn't fit," he told the Washington Post. Anyway, he's also said that the pledge requirement to give away at least half of one's wealth sounds too modest. "If you're only going to give away 50% of your wealth, come on, I'm going to do much more than that." Since D'Aniello is currently worth nearly $3 billion, it would seem that dramatically higher levels of giving lie ahead. That sounds like good news for AEI. Despite all the money conservative think tanks have raised in recent years, much more is on the way. Marrying policy and politics. Gifts to policy groups often go hand in hand with other kinds of giving that aims to have influence. Many top backers of right-wing think tanks are also major contributors to Republican Party committees and GOP-aligned super PACs. This overlap is nothing new, and you also see it on the left, but it's soared in recent years, and some of the newer donors coming on the scene are pulling all levers with particular gusto. A leading example is Robert Mercer, another brainy guy who made his fortune in finance. Growing up, Mercer was obsessed with computers, learning to code in high school, back before personal computers existed. After receiving his PhD in computer science from the University of Illinois, he worked at IBM, where he developed speech recognition programs. In 1993, Mercer joined Renaissance Technologies, the hedge fund founded by math whiz Jim Simons, which employed quantitative models based on mathematical and statistical models to predict movements in the market. It was a smart career move. Renaissance became one of the most successful hedge funds of all time. More about Jim Simons later in this book. Mercer rose to become co-CEO of the firm. In some recent years, he's earned over $100 million. Starting in 2012, Mercer emerged as one of the right's top political donors, giving $5.4 million to conservative candidates and outside groups. He gave even more in the 2014 election cycle, $9.2 million. Mercer contributed more money that year to a Koch-created outfit, the Freedom Partners Action Fund, than did the Koch brothers themselves. In 2016, he was the single biggest donor during the presidential primaries, pouring over $13 million into Ted Cruz's super PAC. That Cruz didn't win underscores how campaign donations can disappear down the drain. The contributors to Jeb Bush's campaign got an even worse return on their investment. Later, he helped bankroll Donald Trump's campaign. Shrewdly, though, Mercer is a diversified investor when it comes to pursuing influence. The Mercer Family Foundation, which is run by his daughter Rebecca, has given many millions to conservative policy groups, donations that the media has largely ignored, even as the New York Times breathlessly reported in 2015 on Mercer's new kingmaker status as a political donor. That's not unusual. Despite the well-known influence of think tanks, there is little coverage of the river of philanthropic money that goes into these institutions, almost all in the form of tax-deductible gifts. Mercer has backed a wide array of policy groups that put forth a broad vision for a conservative America, as well as detailed plans for curbing taxes and regulation. In a recent year, big money went to the Manhattan Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and a host of state-based think tanks, including the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise in Washington State and the Goldwater Institute for Public Policy in Arizona. Conservative philanthropists often favor state groups because grant money goes further there. They also love pounding on the mainstream media for alleged liberal bias, which is why Mercer has given millions to the Media Research Center, which says its mission is to bring balance to the news media. Another recipient of one of Mercer's biggest gifts has been the Federalist Society, a group that reports that it has created a conservative and libertarian intellectual network that extends to all levels of the legal community. Mercer money has also flowed to a newer group, the Government Accountability Institute, where Rebecca has sat on the board. The institute says its mission is to expose crony capitalism, misuse of taxpayer monies, and other government corruption or malfeasance. Mainly, though, GAI is a platform for Peter Schweitzer, author of the book Clinton Cash, an attack on Bill and Hillary Clinton's finances that was carefully timed for the 2016 election cycle. Much of its work has focused on investigating the Clintons, along with the Clinton Foundation. This kind of thing, 501c3 nonprofits that are de facto partisan attack dogs, is increasingly common. Nearly all of Robert Mercer's policy giving has been to groups with a broad ideological agenda, as opposed to a focus on any specific issue. Many conservative funders give the same way, seeing investing in multi-issue think tanks and leadership development institutes as the best way to move public debates by influencing the overall narratives around the economy, social policy, and national security. Think tanks are natural partners for political parties and candidates, which also put forth sweeping visions. And there's a long history of politicians relying heavily on think tanks to do the heavy intellectual lifting of creating policy positions. This has been especially true of Republicans, who have fewer friends in academia than the Democrats. The Heritage Foundation famously supplied the new Reagan administration with a detailed plan for governing in 1981, the first of many policy blueprints it developed to guide Republican officials. A long list of GOP stars have spoken at its galas. Liberal money pushes back. For many years, conservative donors were largely alone in grasping the clout of think tanks. While these funders built up places like Heritage, AEI, and the Cato Institute into powerful policy battleships, liberal philanthropists tended to direct their money to specific causes, writing checks to advocacy groups working on such single issues as the environment, abortion, or LGBT rights. Starting in the late 1990s, though, more leaders on the left started to worry that a grab bag of causes didn't add up to a compelling liberal vision for America. And, with Republicans firmly in control of Congress, swept into power by the intellectual Newt Gingrich and his big picture, Contract with America, liberals fretted about how the right was winning the war of ideas. In 1997, a philanthropy watchdog group published an in-depth report by Sally Covington, Moving a Policy Agenda, The Strategic Philanthropy of Conservative Foundations, on the right's public policy investments over the previous two decades, documenting just how much funding was quietly flowing to such work and how much influence it had at both the national and the state level. A follow-up report on Moving a Policy Agenda, which I wrote, showed that conservative donors had pumped well over $1 billion into just the top 20 think tanks on the right during the 1990s, and that these organizations had grown more sophisticated at waging battle in the political arena, in close concert with Republicans on issues like Social Security, Medicare, taxes, and education. Many operate like extra-party organizations, I wrote, adopting the tactics of the permanent political campaign. A key finding of these reports was that conservative philanthropists were investing in the ideal levers of influence in an era when voting rates were low and mass movements were weak. With elites making more decisions in America while ordinary citizens were checking out of civic life, efforts to sway high-level policy debates with research and ideas paid big dividends. Whoever could win the larger ideological battles could win everything else. Covington had some sharp words about the failure of big foundations, like Ford, to adapt to this new reality. She wrote, "Conservative funders see themselves as part of a larger movement to defeat big government liberalism, and they fund accordingly. But mainstream foundations prefer to make modest, on-the-ground improvements in specific neighborhoods. As a result, mainstream foundations increasingly operate within the larger policy assumptions and parameters that conservative funders help shape. While Covington's report got wide attention among liberal funders, few of these foundations were interested in going head-to-head with conservatives in the war of ideas. However, such intellectual combat did appeal to some of the major new wealthy donors that emerged on the left during George W. Bush's first term as president. Foremost among these were Herb and Marion Sandler, a couple who had become billionaires after moving to California in the 1960s and building up Golden West, a savings and loan association, over 40 years. Herb had grown up Jewish on New York's Lower East Side and become a lawyer. He was working at a small firm in Manhattan where, by his description, he was really a nobody when he met Marion Osher, a Wellesley grad with an MBA. Osher was among the few female securities analysts on Wall Street, where she had become the leading expert on the savings and loan industry. "She was a superstar," Herb told me. Through her research, Marion had come to view the S&L industry as an overlooked area primed for growth. With financial help from her brother, Bernard, she and Herb bought Golden West Savings, a small bank in Oakland with just one branch, for over $3 million in 1963. Marion had a keen understanding of which S&Ls did well and why, and the couple scaled up the bank in a careful, deliberate way. Acting as co-CEOs, they kept costs low and built a conservative loan portfolio while also experimenting with new products like adjustable-rate mortgages. After going public in 1968, they made a series of acquisitions and ultimately turned Golden West into one of the largest thrift banks in the United States. They would eventually sell out to Wachovia in 2006 at the height of the housing boom for $24 billion, walking away with $2.4 billion. The Sandlers first turned to philanthropy in a serious way in 1988, after nearly two decades of accumulating wealth. "I had never had any money," Herb said, "so for me, this was astonishing." The spark for philanthropy was the death of Herb's brother at the age of 62. That event focused the couple on what life was really about, and they began thinking hard about what they might do with their wealth, ultimately deciding they wanted to give most of it away. The Sandlers made sure their two children, James and Susan, were part of that decision, as many wealthy couples do when they consider large-scale philanthropy. Such inclusion doesn't just reduce the likelihood of conflict later on, it's a chance to create a true family project that can span generations. The Sandlers aimed to give away money with the same deliberate rationality with which they had made it. Together, with their kids, they worked with a flip chart to think through priorities. Everyone came with lists, and everyone had a veto over final choices. "It had to be something that interested everyone," Herb said. Another criterion was that giving had to focus on big problems and promise to materially improve people's lives. The first decision to emerge from this process was to support Human Rights Watch, a group that fights injustice around the world, then still in a formative growth period. It wasn't a surprising choice. Even as the Sandlers grew wealthy, they never drifted from their liberal world view. "I had always identified with the underdogs," Herb said of his growing up. His father gambled on horses and was forever in debt. The family lived in publicly subsidized housing. Marion's parents were more affluent, but that hadn't always been the case. They were Jewish immigrants from Lithuania and Russia, who had owned a hardware store before they did well in real estate. To Herb, the fact that he and Marion had ended up wealthy had as much to do with luck and timing as anything else. He knew that many other people weren't so fortunate. "The world is an incredibly unfair place," Herb said, adding, "I can't stand powerful people taking advantage of vulnerable people." In the following years, the Sandlers' early philanthropy came to include big investments in health and also basic science. But gifts to make society more fair would remain a constant. And always, the family operated with a keen eye for places where their money could make a decisive difference. They wanted to make things happen that wouldn't otherwise happen. After George W. Bush took office in 2001, the Sandlers started focusing on public policy in a bigger way, believing that more needed to be done to save America from an ascendant right wing. They became preoccupied with the question of why conservative ideas had become so influential in the first place. After some digging, the Sandlers learned how savvy right-wing funders had bankrolled groups like Heritage and AEI to shift the terms of national policy on issues such as welfare, regulation, taxes, and the role of government as a whole. Herb, in particular, spent hours doing internet research to trace the funding and see why the right had done so well. He read Moving a Policy Agenda, along with the 1971 Powell Memo that had laid out a long-term game plan for moving U.S. public policy to the right. Soon enough, the Sandlers came to embrace the wisdom of backing visionary think tanks rather than supporting narrow work on specific issues, as so many liberal donors were doing. The next question became where exactly to put their money. From their years in business, the couple were big believers in due diligence, and they brought this mindset to their exploration of think tanks, a world they knew little about. They embarked on an extended listening tour of the liberal policy universe, which included sessions with top staff at existing think tanks. Marion Sandler became well known for asking brusque questions while knitting during meetings, coming across more as a grandmother than as a veteran business executive, until she opened her mouth. The Sandlers weren't impressed with what they found as they made the rounds, coming away disinclined to back any of the existing policy institutes on the left. A better path, they decided, would be to create something new from scratch, a think tank that could someday rival Heritage or AEI. And so the Sandlers began looking for an entrepreneurial leader whom they could bankroll to build a high-powered Washington think tank, a quest that eventually led them to John Podesta, who had been Bill Clinton's chief of staff, among other roles. Podesta had been noodling around with his own ideas for creating a new progressive policy center and struck the Sandlers as a promising candidate to trust with millions of dollars. In keeping with their belief in due diligence, the couple talked to over 24 people who had worked with Podesta in government. The reports on him were so positive that Herb was sure there had to be a catch. "I was prepared to dislike him." Eventually, though, the Sandlers became convinced that all the rave reviews were true. They committed an initial $20 million in funding to Podesta, on the condition that he take on the job of building the new think tank full-time. It would be called the Center for American Progress, CAP. Over the following decade, CAP emerged as the flagship progressive policy shop in Washington, drawing donations from many other wealthy donors. The billionaire hedge fund manager Tom Steyer contributed at a major level, as did Glenn Hutchins, a successful private equity investor who had done a stint in the Clinton administration before moving on to the hugely successful Blackstone Group. Both Steyer and Hutchins joined CAP's board, which also came to include another mega donor, the Swiss billionaire Hans-Jörg Wyss. Funding also came to CAP from the Democracy Alliance, DA, a network of wealthy progressives co-founded in 2005 by Rob Stein, a former Clinton aide. 5 years after Covington's report came out, Stein put together a hard-hitting PowerPoint presentation on the influence of conservative policy groups and a growing right-wing media establishment led by Fox News. Stein's PowerPoint galvanized a strong response among top Democratic donors, who came together to launch the Democracy Alliance, whose partners began giving millions of dollars a year in gifts to organizations recommended by the DA's staff. CAP was among the biggest grantees. As it grew, CAP hewed to the influence model of the big conservative think tanks. It invested as heavily in communications and legislative outreach as it did in research, fielding a large staff that focused on connecting its policy work to public officials and the media. And, like places such as AEI, it developed strong ties to partisan politicians. When Barack Obama took office in 2009, numerous CAP staffers joined his administration. Eventually, John Podesta himself went to work for Obama, leaving the management of CAP in the hands of Neera Tanden, a former aide to Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, the Sandlers also embraced the dual-track giving model that so many wealthy conservatives followed, making major political contributions in addition to bankrolling policy groups. They were among the biggest donors in the 2004 election, joining other billionaires in a push to oust Bush from office. They would never give as much again, but did remain major political donors. CAP isn't the only think tank that receives grants from the Sandler Foundation, which is based in San Francisco and run by Herb and his children, as well as a small staff giving out tens of millions of dollars annually. Marion Sandler died in 2012. Funds also flow to other top policy groups, including the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the Center for Responsible Lending, which the Sandlers also helped create, along with the investigative journalism shop ProPublica. In 2013, the foundation began bankrolling a new scholarly center in Washington to research the link between inequality and economic growth, taking on the long-standing argument that efforts to temper inequalities inevitably slow the economy. The Washington Center for Equitable Growth is all about supporting academic research, distributing tens of thousands of dollars in grants for rigorous studies. But it was founded with a close eye on politics, looking to bolster Democratic arguments for middle-out economics, the idea that reducing inequality and boosting the middle class is a key to faster growth. Heather Boucher, the center's first director, told me the goal is to integrate this work into the policy process and knit it into a larger picture of the economy. The logic behind the center was compelling for a funder like Herb Sandler, who was always on the lookout for ways to leverage his gifts. If a shift occurred in the macroeconomic debate over inequality, it would be easier to win policy battles on a range of issues, such as raising the minimum wage and reforming tax policy. Newcomers. Not every philanthropist keen to sway public policy wants to join an ideological team. Some see the arms race between left and right think tanks as precisely what's wrong with politics, and aim to bust this duopoly. So it was that in the early spring of 2015, Sean Parker and Ron Conway, two Silicon Valley veterans, helped to launch a new policy center in Washington called the Economic Innovation Group. It's time for a paradigm shift in the way we think about growth, investment, and job creation, said Steve Glickman, executive director and co-founder of the group. Important voices are missing from the policy debate, and Washington is mired in the same stale conversations. Parker had made his career disrupting yesterday's industries, initially through Napster and then as the first president of Facebook. Conway was a legend in the Valley for his long string of savvy angel investments in breakthrough companies. Just 2 years earlier, Conway had told the New York Times, "I really don't have a lot of interest in national politics, and it's because I'm a skeptic. I don't want to spin the wheels and not get anything done." But apparently the temptation of backing a startup gunning to change business as usual in the nation's capital was more than he could resist. Conway and Parker were outsiders in Washington, which was exactly the point. Who better to upend existing policy models than the folks who had invented stuff like Google? "It's time for those of us in the tech community to look beyond the borders of Silicon Valley and to think long-term about solutions to broader national challenges," said Parker. "Our approach to public policy should leverage the lessons we learned as technology entrepreneurs and investors. Take big risks, seek out innovative solutions, and don't shy away from big problems." New money stampeding into town with grand plans is an old story in Washington. and this was the second such foray by techies that Parker had helped launch. Along with Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, and others, he had also been a co-founder of Forward.us, an immigration advocacy effort started in 2013 that was widely seen as clumsy and ineffective. Parker said that Silicon Valley's leaders had learned from that effort. "There's a genuine idealism to Forward's mission," he told Politico. "But its early tactics were perceived cynically. The right approach is probably more cautious and prudent." Parker added, though, that mimicking the tactics of existing Beltway policy shops was definitely not the answer, since those groups had become shills for the party line. He said that if the Economic Innovation Group was going to be successful, it needs to be a neutral and honest broker. Rachel Pritzker is another philanthropist who has sought to move beyond existing ideological paradigms by backing new ideas. Pritzker told me that she's been involved in philanthropy my whole life. It was something instilled in my family. That would be the famous and sprawling Pritzker family, which includes 11 billionaires and has a combined net worth of some $30 billion, originally derived from the Hyatt hotel chain, but pumped up by various other investments over the decades. Today, so many Pritzkers are involved in philanthropy that it can be hard to keep them all straight. Rachel belongs to the fourth generation of Pritzkers, and like many younger philanthropists, she's intent on doing things differently. Her first major foray into giving was during the early 2000s, when she became a founding board member of the Democracy Alliance. Pritzker was galvanized by the PowerPoint presentation given by Rob Stein, documenting the enormous power of conservative groups and media outlets. She was struck by Stein's point that progressives were losing because we weren't winning hearts and minds, and plunged headlong into helping create the DA, investing time and money to get the organization going. She also served on the board of Media Matters for America, a group that pushes back against right-wing media outlets like Fox News. The Democracy Alliance focuses heavily on near-term policy and political battles with a keen eye on the electoral cycle. After a time, though, Pritzker found her own attention shifting to a different set of challenges, the kind that often can't get traction in the politics of the moment. "I wanted to think longer term and focus more on original problem-solving ideas," she said. And to do that, she felt she needed to get out of Washington, D.C., and the way its endless, zero-sum ideological warfare locked people into narrow world views. Pritzker moved to the Bay Area, and, as she remembered, started hanging out with people who were having big and bold conversations. Among the kindred spirits she connected to over time were the co-founders of the Breakthrough Institute, Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger, who'd made a name for themselves by advancing iconoclastic ideas, most famously through their essay, The Death of Environmentalism. The Breakthrough Institute has described itself as a paradigm-shifting think tank committed to modernizing environmentalism for the 21st century. And it lists audacity and imagination as among its core values. The place is the antithesis of a typical Beltway policy shop, and Pritzker loved it, becoming one of its biggest donors and the chair of its advisory board. Pritzker also tapped her family fortune to set up her own foundation, the Pritzker Innovation Fund, which works mainly on climate and energy issues, with the goal of developing and advancing paradigm-shifting ideas to address wicked problems. Pritzker describes wicked problems as problems without easy solutions. They aren't just complex problems, they are extraordinarily complex problems. Climate change, along with sustainable energy use, is the top wicked problem on her fund's agenda. While there are some clear ways to make progress in this area, like, say, raising the price of carbon to change incentives around energy use, the larger, more daunting challenge is ensuring that all of humanity, some 9 billion people eventually, will have access to energy without creating an ecological catastrophe. Pritzker told me that even the very basic question of how much energy humans need to have a high-quality life has not been as closely analyzed as you might think. To her, this is a perfect example of where smart philanthropy can make a difference by underwriting new intellectual work, which is the main focus of the Pritzker Innovation Fund, with grants going to think tanks and policy research. Pritzker's view is that new ideas can create paradigmatic shifts in approaches that break through polarization and gridlock by changing the terms of debate. In other words, Rachel Pritzker is another philanthropist who believes that ideas are the ultimate leverage point. Use your money to change the conversation, and you can change everything else. Many top philanthropists have never given a dime to think tanks, and never will. They don't like the thought of writing checks to a bunch of policy wonks and PhDs when their cash could go to more direct efforts to solve problems. Think tank work can seem awfully detached from the real world. Yet, anyone who looks more closely can see how policy groups help orchestrate what happens on any number of issues that concretely affect the lives of millions of people. The billions invested in conservative think tanks, starting in the 1970s, helped move U.S. public policy to the right, ushering in an era of low taxes, deregulation, and cuts to government programs. Eventually, though, those investments triggered a response, with a new set of wealthy progressive donors emerging to push back against inequality, using some of the same funding tactics perfected by right-wing philanthropists. Still, in general, far more money is going into policy work friendly to corporations and Wall Street. For example, the two national think tanks that directly stand up for workers, the Economic Policy Institute and the National Employment Law Project, together had revenues of under $15 million in a recent year. That's less than half the money raised annually by the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank that dreams of abolishing the U.S. Department of Labor, along with plenty of other federal agencies, and is heavily backed by Wall Street donors as well as the Koch family. AEI and Heritage, in turn, are far bigger than Cato. This ongoing imbalance of power, though, shouldn't obscure the fact that big changes have occurred in think tank funding in the past 15 years. More wealthy progressives, like Herb Sandler, have arrived on the scene, a trend that underscores how the upper class is increasingly diverse in its ideology. Class and politics don't line up as neatly as they once did, in an earlier era when industrialists slugged it out with labor unions. Many of the new rich are highly educated knowledge workers who grew up and live in blue America and favor a strong government that invests in public goods like education, scientific research, and infrastructure. They wish the public sector was more nimble and effective, but they're not anti-statists and they don't mind paying higher taxes. In fact, such billionaires as Warren Buffett and Reed Hastings have publicly campaigned for tax increases. Hastings even published an op-ed in 2009 titled, "Please Raise My Taxes." Others, like Nick Hanauer, an early investor in Amazon, has strongly argued that inequality hurts the economy by undermining middle-class buying and poses a profound threat to social stability. Hanauer wrote in a widely read 2014 article in Politico that the model for us rich guys here should be Henry Ford, who realized that all his auto workers in Michigan weren't only cheap labor to be exploited, they were consumers too. If America took dramatic steps to reduce inequality, Hanauer predicted that people like him would most certainly get even richer. On the other hand, if income gaps kept growing, he envisioned pitchforks coming. He wrote, "I have a message for my fellow filthy rich, for all of us who live in our gated bubble worlds. Wake up, people. It won't last." Overall, the wealthy remain more conservative than ordinary Americans on issues like labor policy, regulation, and taxes. But there are now enough rich liberals engaged in philanthropy to ensure that the far upper class isn't a monolithic bloc backing conservative and centrist viewpoints. That is translating into a far more robust war of ideas. We hear a lot about how politically polarized America is these days. What we don't often hear is that, like the rest of us, the wealthy are also more divided than ever. This means that even as the new philanthropic power elite has come to wield even more influence, that clout is rarely directed in any one uniform direction when it comes to the great issues of the day. Chapter 4. Super Citizens. Not long before Thanksgiving 2014, readers of the New York Times learned that a new island park was going to be built in the Hudson River, off the west side of Manhattan, in Chelsea. Plans for the 2.4-acre park, built on Pier 54, where the Titanic survivors had returned to New York, called for walkways, lawns, and 3 performance spaces. It would be the most ambitious new park in New York in years, costing around $170 million. The majority of that tab would be picked up by the media mogul Barry Diller and his wife, the fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg. The couple have offices within walking distance of each other, not far from the Hudson. Diller is in the stylish white glass building across from Chelsea Piers that he had Frank Gehry design for his company, IAC. The building is a few blocks from the site of the new park, which was quickly dubbed Diller Island. The corporate headquarters for Furstenberg's company are in the Meatpacking District on 14th Street. The neighborhood has changed dramatically in recent years, from the days when transvestite prostitutes worked the cobblestone streets and a biker's bar was among the few night spots. The Meatpacking District has become an upscale destination, with the Highline Park, a striking public space built on an abandoned elevated rail line, bringing in throngs of tourists. Real estate values have gone into the stratosphere. Diller and Furstenberg were the biggest donors to the Highline, a park financed largely with private donations that stretches through much of West Chelsea, starting just below 14th Street and ending at 34th Street. The other top backer of the park was the Pershing Square Foundation, which is run by the billionaire hedge fund investor Bill Ackman and his wife Karen. The Highline has transformed a neighborhood once known for auto repair shops and self-storage spaces. As the park was completed in stages, new glass apartment towers sprang up on either side, with 2- and 3-bedroom units going for millions of dollars. One journalist wrote, "The Highline has been to usual gentrification what a bomb is to bottle rockets." In 2015, the Whitney opened its new art museum on Ganzevoort Street, an expensive move downtown paid for by a stable of wealthy donors. The museum drew even more visitors to the neighborhood. Longtime Chelsea residents complained as yet another corner of New York was turned into a playground for rich people and tourists. Diller Island will amp things up even further, sitting like a flying saucer in the Hudson and visible from both the Highline and the Whitney. It will be yet another draw for outsiders. I have always liked the idea of public art and public spaces, and that's just been growing in me over decades, Diller would say later about why he backed the project. It isn't going to cure world disease, but it's totally worthwhile. Diller and Furstenberg were early signers of the Giving Pledge, and Diller in particular is a big fan of the group's annual retreats. I don't think there's another group like it anywhere. A room full of very complex personalities, of drive and aspiration, of ego and curiosity, all engaged in wanting to help solve problems for others, Diller wrote in a letter to Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. Diller liked the retreats so much that he offered to help pay their costs, only to be assured that the Gates Foundation had things covered. He and Furstenberg have given away millions through their foundation, spreading grants around in both New York and Los Angeles to an array of causes that includes the arts, human rights, human services, and environmental conservation. But the commitment for Pier 54 was far bigger than anything that had come before. The announcement of the new park triggered instant controversy. It had been planned in secrecy by the Hudson River Trust, which enlisted Diller and then quietly got buy-in from Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Bill de Blasio. community members on the far west side and their elected representatives learned about Diller Island along with the rest of the readers of the New York Times. One element of the project that raised hackles was that the park, which would also require $40 million in public funds to be completed, would actually be controlled by Barry Diller